I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. And welcome to the penultimate episode, episode 130 of season 6 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today, as almost always in every one of my seasons on the second to last episode, is my good friend Agent Palmer. Welcome back to the show, Jason.
Thank you for having me. I have to tell you, it was weird to watch what I consider a holiday movie, not during the holidays. But I will say, it still kind of fits regardless of when you watch it.
I should hope so. That's the way it should be.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, come on. You know. I mean, you fit into the same category as I do. I mean, I don't celebrate Christmas. So for me, you know, I don't think of movies as Christmas movies.
Well, yeah,
they might be holiday movies.
Yeah,
but holiday, you know, I don't look at them from a religious perspective.
Yeah, that's fair. I will say we had a warm up in I don't know, mid March, we'll say, and
okay,
that's when I watched. I watched this movie during a warm up, a 70-degree March day, and.
Okay, but in your mind, you get to see the snow and the coldness of it all and stuff like that.
My friends were like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Look, until we hit mid-April, I'm always prepared for another snowstorm, as long as it says March or like early April." So like, I'm very prepared for the weather to just screw me at some point. So I'm fine with it. I actually thought this was a wonderful treat. Like as just a
unintended.
Yeah. It worked out. It's probably one of those holiday movies. I actually watch.
Okay, good. Did you convince Stephanie to watch it with you?
She's watched it with. I was the one who introduced. No, I think her. She used to watch it with her mother. We did a few years ago, as a. I don't know. I guess you'll call it an exercise. We watched the colorized version, and never again. Oh my God!
It was. I've never watched the colorized version, but I've seen pictures of it, and it just looks. They you know, Ted Turner really loved using pink hues. And, you know, it just shouts too much.
There's a reason you shoot in black and white to begin with. I mean, and that's the point.
That's right.
And so,
exactly.
So I just go, but I can say I watched it once and that allows
me to say, I can't, never so that's again. Fine. And I'm okay. I'm okay with still saying never again.
I mean, I did. I
always, you know, it's the same thing. I can use it in the same example of, you know, if you've seen the theatrical versions of the Lord of the Rings movies, you know, I saw them in the theater because that's what they had to offer at the time. But then when the extended versions came out, I was like, I'm never going to watch those theatrical versions ever again.
I agree. And I would also say that when I was doing a search to find whatever platform it was going to be on for me again, I found the abridged version. Which I went, wait, the abridged version is 1 hour and 46 minutes. And I was almost tempted to watch it just to be like, well, what 20 minutes did they take out? But if you take 20 minutes out of a 2+ hour movie, I'm not considering that abridged. Like, it's still 1 hour and 46. Like,
it's more than your 90 minute, You know, and I know you like 90-minute movies.
I prefer them, but a movie like It's a Wonderful Life, 2+ hours, probably not looking at my watch or my phone through it. That's fine. It doesn't feel like 2.5 hours or 2:10 or right. whatever it is. Like, and that's right. what it is for me.
2:11 because you're on episode 2:10. Unless you didn't watch the last minute because of that. You know.
No,
I don't need to see that. Know, it's after me.
Yeah, that's somebody else's problem. No.
It's in the future. No,
it was fun. It was fun revisiting it. And you know, usually we put it on during the holidays when like other things are happening.
Okay.
So it's never, or it's very rarely a sit down and watch all of it.
Okay. That's fair too. And again, if you've seen the movie so many times, it doesn't make a difference if you're not watching it all of it.
This is,
you know,
yeah.
You know, it's you know, there's the idea that if something's playing, you'll watch it in the background. You know, if it's on, you'll watch it in the background, even if you're seeing bits and pieces of it. I mean, me being a completionist, I can't do that. I have a problem. I cannot start watching a movie 5 minutes into it. You know,
even if you've seen it a million times,
if I've seen it a million times, it drives me nuts. Drives me crazy. I gotta start it from the beginning, which is also why most of the time I watch movies by myself, because if I watch them with somebody else and they start talking or I miss something or whatever it is, it just drives me nuts. Because if it's me just watching it on my own and I miss something, so then I rewind. Yeah, you know, I don't have a problem with that. But you know, you can't say it to everybody, especially if you're with other people. You can't say, "Oh, can you just go back 30 seconds? I just missed something that someone said."
Yeah, if I have a talker in the house, I'll put on closed captions.
Yeah, but closed captions doesn't help if they're talking to you.
Well, they know I'm they're talking to others.
Yeah. That's okay. I always have closed captions on. That's always there regardless.
Okay.
You know, as much as I can. Every so often, you know, there are movies that don't have the closed caption properly. But other than that, if I find them, they're there.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, that's like a rule for me, I guess you can say.
All right.
If I can have, I do.
So,
you know, that type of thing.
I was trying to figure out, because you always ask me this question when I first watched this movie, and
I was just about to ask you that.
I literally cannot figure it out. Like I know I watched parts of it when I was much younger and it would be on TV and somebody else would watch it. Or I'd watch it at, you know, parts of it in other people's homes. I feel like there's a possibility that it was only in the last decade that I sit down and watched it all the way through for the first time. You know, I'd seen parts. Okay. I knew how it ended. I knew this, that, and the other thing. But it was only in the last decade that I was like, you know what? I think it's time to put it all together and not see bit and that.
Right. But what's cool about that is when you think about it, you say, okay, you know, since when you're older, you can appreciate it more.
Oh yeah. This is definitely like, this is one of those movies that's kind of wasted on youth, because like,
yes. And that's a line that's mentioned in the movie too.
Oh no! Yeah, no! Don't.
But that's kissing.
You know what? That's the thing that got me while I was watching this, because I like to do my homework. I mean, even though I know this movie, I do rewatch it as close to recording with you as possible. And the thing that struck out to me, and I always forget this, and I don't know why, it's so funny. Like it's so funny of a movie. Like it's not a comedy. I'm not going to say that. But like all the lines that. And beats and like little comedic things. Not only, you know, youth is wasted on the young and that kind of stuff, but just everything that's supposed to be funny really hits so well.
Yes. Oh, God, Capra did an amazing job writing this movie. You know, along with he wrote it with like six other people in the end. You know, they polished it really, really well.
It almost feels like that formulaic of like a Marvel movie where like every 10 minutes you're getting at least one laugh. Like, and it's not exactly that formulaic, but he never lets
and this is in some ways a tragedy. So, you know,
it is, but like, he never lets you go too far before, like, okay, maybe sprinkle a little more sugar on this.
Right. Exactly. Oh, for sure. That's just amazing the way that he does this. So minute 130 begins with George responding to Mary's questions and ends with like a second of the final credits of the movie, which we see for like, it just flashes on the screen. It's one of those subliminal messages, the way that it looks just by saying that. I mean, we're not even going to talk about it because there's nothing to talk about because you see it just for a flash of a second. So, I'll get to that tomorrow. There's no need to talk about all that flash of a second here. It would have been great if it actually ended exactly, at the Liberty Bell ringing. But, oh, well.
Yeah.
Plus. I'm talking about the movie. I'm talking about this minute.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, I mean, I was just excited to have like an actual memorable movie moment in my minute here at the end. Finally, like,
there you go. See, no credits for you.
No.
Well, once again, when you did The Great Escape, did you have,
I mean, he was
in The Great Escape. You did 2 minutes.
Yeah. So, but
I think he
was walked back in.
I think you did get the baseball
and he got the baseball. But it's not aligned, though. Like, this is a line. This is,
yes.
I mean, it's said throughout the film. It's not the first time. But, like, it's, like, we've been building to this.
Correct.
For the last 45 minutes of the film. I mean, the rest of all of it's set up. And then we're like, all right, now we're going. It's time. And then, bam, here we go.
Right.
Yeah.
So whatever. Let's just quickly go through the dialogue that's here because there isn't that much that is said in this minute. There's a lot that happens, but as you said, it's basically just giving us a rundown of ending everything in the whole party that we've been watching over the last few days.
Yeah.
So Mary had asked George at the end of yesterday's episode, where's that book from that he's looking at? We read the inscription that Clarence had put in Tom Sawyer. And so George basically starts off by saying, that's a Christmas present from a very dear friend of mine. So, to me, it's very interesting that he's like smiling when he tells this to Mary. And it made me wonder, on the one hand, he's very happy to inform, the love of his life, where this present came from. But do you think sometime in the future he's going to tell her the story of what happened, or is she just going to look at him and send him to the loony bin?
I mean, she's stuck with him for like, she's the amount of stuff just in this movie alone that she's put up with. The canceled honeymoons, the missed the glaring billboard he needed to fall in love with her, like, or to finally push him over the edge, like all of the stuff she's put up with up to this point, I think she wouldn't, like, she'd believe him, and I feel like there would be a guilt trip coming his way of like, you really, like, you needed an angel to tell you that the world is better off with you. I feel like that's a guilt trip Mary's going to give him of like, followed by a, why didn't you just tell me? Like,
that's a good point. Yeah, I think so. Okay. It's an interesting way to look at it, because again, back in when this is taking place, back in 1945, I guess people were thinking less about science fiction. It wouldn't have been the type of thing where, she would have said, oh, you're just thinking of, I mean, we've talked so much about Back to the Future in this whole season, but, it goes back to that from 1955, George in George McFly, not George Bailey, is a fan of science fiction that's just basically starting out at that point, being so much more popular. You know, so, you know, that's why he got convinced by, you know, Darth Vader from the planet Vulcan, you know.
I think based on belief, you know, it feels so wholesome that absolutely she'd believe him.
But do you think he would feel the need to tell her?
No, I think she'd have to, again, she would have to coax it out of him. I mean, it's the same way as how this movie ends, with her helping him without him asking. Right. Which I feel like maybe she gets to learn the truth about Clarence, because there's going to be a time when all those people leave and the money's back in the bank that she goes, why didn't you just ask for help? Why did you go running all over town?
Because he's a man.
Well, I know that, but like Mary,
he wasn't asking for directions.
Mary's fairly progressive, like in her proactiveness on behalf of her man throughout this whole thing. She's the one that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, she's dollars. So exactly $2,000. But yeah. Right. I mean, I actually even talked about this earlier in the week when I had my guest on, Mary Owen, you know, the daughter of Donna Reed.
Yeah.
And I mean, I basically talked about the fact that, you know, the way that her mother plays this character and the way that this character of Mary is written goes against everything that they did in the 1940s. You know, when you have a story that's revolving around a man, in most movies from that time period, the woman was just an extraneous character. But here she is the part of the story that pushes George along to everything that happens. You know, you said, she's the one who suggests using the $2,000. She's the one who goes and buys, you know, the old house for them to renovate. She does the renovation of that house.
Yeah.
You know, she lets him do everything. She's the.
I don't know when the cliche started of behind every good man is a good woman, but like Mary is exhibit A.
Yes.
And maybe the first real exhibit of that on film. Right. And I think
I would say that she's exhibit A, B, C, D, and E.
I think it may also be what makes this movie timeless. Is because we've gotten to a point now where Mary's common, maybe not common, but she's not uncommon. So it fits into a narrative of today where women can be the saviors. Right. It's
not catalyst. That's the word I was looking for. Okay. She's the catalyst of everything. Sorry, I knew I'd find that word eventually. You know.
Yeah. No, I like that. I think that it's if anything, this movie is telling you, especially men, you can share. Like,
that's right.
I mean, I Clarence is a fun character, but wholly unnecessary if George just opens up to Mary at literally at any point. After
true, money but, goes but missing. I don't know if Mary would have been able to convince him that, you know, his life has meaning.
I don't know. She was able to convince him of a lot, you know, because he was against buying the old house to begin with. And even though it's the first thing he does as a like a point of like getting angry, he's happy she did it. Like in the end, everything she does for him, he's eventually happy he did. She did.
That's right. I agree with you on that. But I think part of the idea here is that George is still always dreaming of that other life until now. Now he's finally come down to earth and said, okay, you know what? I don't need to be an engineer that's going to be traveling around the world. Sorry, I don't need to be an engineer without an engineering degree to go around the world and build bridges and skyscrapers and all that stuff, which, again, I don't know how he would have done that without a degree. But, whatever. But he always was dreaming about these things. But now he's grounded and he realizes that this is where he was meant to be.
With the exception that Mary perpetuated that myth as much as anyone. She could have, that's a conversation they probably just never had. Because George was so hard luck for basically the entire beginning of this film that I feel like she liked the optimism. Because it's one of those like catch-22s where you can't take that optimism away, because that optimism is why he said, I'll get you the moon. You know, without that kind of like, I'm going to go everywhere and do these amazing things, he probably doesn't have the confidence to say, I'll lasso you the moon. Like, he just doesn't. Right. So I think it's part of the character, and I think that's why she enables him, if by no other reason than not squashing his dream while he's doing these other things. But at some point,
I mean, again, she lets him have his area in the living room where he's building stuff. You know, he's building models and he's got all these blueprints and plans like that. So, you know, she's letting him keep that as a hobby.
Yeah. Well, but at some point,
you know, like our significant others let us do, you know, podcasting.
Yeah. I mean, but it feels like at some point, you know, Mary's going to be the one, and it's going to be Mary in the sequel to this movie. Mary's the one who says, you have been building bridges and making dreams come true for everyone else. And it feels like it's important that she's the one that says that to him, despite the fact that it's Clarence who turns him around as far as enjoying what he already has. I think she's the one to point out, well, this is all the dreams and things you've done already.
That's true. I think in the sequel to this, Mary's the one who finds out where the money went and goes over and poisons Potter or something like that. You know,
just all you need. I mean, all, just one solid guilt trip. Because the one thing about Potter is, I don't think he's had any women in his life at all. It feels like they made him so miserly that maybe he's got a cleaning lady that hates him, but he's always surrounded by men. And assistants and stuff. So, like, he doesn't even have a secretary in this, really. Maybe.
Yeah, he does. Sure, he does. He calls in the secretary, who George yells at also.
But all I'm saying,
that goes for you, too.
Yeah. But it feels like they're all subordinates, though. I feel like Mary just gives him a massive guilt trip. And he probably either A, has a heart attack, or B, you know, coughs up the money. Which he probably invested, right. And he's going to keep the interest and give you the principal, because that's definitely the kind of character he is.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that assessment. You know, because he's the irony is he's trying to make all this money, but like, what does he want to do with this money in the end?
That's a good question. It feels like greed for greed's sake, right? Like this is. The 1940s edition of Gordon Gekko. That's what Potter is, right? Greed is good.
Yeah.
He's just not doing it in Michael Douglas style, let's say.
Yeah, because Michael Douglas got nominated for an Oscar for it, and he didn't. I'm still shocked about that.
Well, look, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Exactly. So basically at this point, you know, he's still holding up Zuzu, who's playing with she starts playing with the book cover. And then we hear like the bell ringing on the Christmas tree. And then she goes, look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. So I never thought about the fact that the teacher that she's referring to is Mrs. Welch, yeah. You know, who let her go home, you know, with her unbuttoned coat, which is practically naked and therefore got a cold.
You know, so this is the thing, right? I'm listening to George go off, and for the first time, I put it together that my grandmother, my bubby, would tell you you're practically naked if you didn't zip up your coat. Like, it is definitely something I have heard before, but like, it
yeah,
did.
I have too.
I never connected it as such of like, oh, that's come from my family. Like, that's not even like, oh, I've seen this in the movie before. Like, no, I'm, you know, and look, I was the one who disappointed my mother. And I, in hindsight, I don't know how I survived, but like, I remember freezing temperatures and going out in a hoodie to the bus stop for 20 minutes. Like, I mean, again, you know, that stamina and strength and, you know, internal warmth is wasted on the youth, because I couldn't do that now.
Right.
But yeah, if my bubby had seen me go to high school, she would have said, "You're practically naked."
I, you know what? When you say it like that, it does ring a bell for me too. No pun intended here. When we're talking about bell ring.
Yeah, true.
I can imagine. You know, one of my grandmothers, if not both of my grandmothers, saying the same thing.
Also,
and you can't say it's a Jewish thing, because there's in this movie, that's not where they're going at all.
No, and I will say though, as a teacher, even in a one-room schoolhouse, which this might be in this small community, which you really
we never know how big Bedford Falls really is.
We don't really know, but we do know that the classroom would have a bell, and how would that come up? Like, at what point would the teacher be like, "Yes, children, class, gather around. Let me tell you what happens when this bell rings." Like, what is it is very like, I like when Clarence says it makes sense. He's coming from a place, if you're buying into angels, of like, this is how it works,
right? Meaning that there aren't many bells, and when you hear a bell, you know that that's what it is.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you're in a schoolhouse where the bell is probably ringing, even in the old days, once to bring you in and once to let you go. So that's twice a day. It's an angel factory, this schoolhouse, right? Okay. All right. Fair. I guess that's what's happening. So there must be a lot of
angels. I never thought of it from that perspective. That's really interesting. You see, even after doing 129 episodes, you're able to bring things in that no one ever thought of and no one ever discussed. Wow. That's why I love having you on here. What can I tell you?
Oh, it's so much fun to discuss these things. Plus, like, I mean, not finally, but you keep giving me movies that I've watched before. So it's very enjoyable.
I do that on purpose.
I would watch a new movie for you. Okay. I would watch a new movie for you.
Maybe eventually we'll get to one.
Maybe we will.
Maybe. Not next season, but maybe.
You know, in fairness, I haven't seen all of the Die Hard franchise.
Okay, but I probably will not be doing all of the Die Hard franchise.
Okay, you're going to stop at what point I stopped, probably. So fair.
No, my at this point, I haven't decided what I'm going to do for 5, but I don't think I'm going to do it minute by minute. Okay. I don't think I could handle that. 4 is still on the roster.
Which one's 5? Is 5 Live Free or?
No, 5 is Russia.
Okay. All right. Well, then 4, I like 4. I've seen up to 4.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. So we're good. We're good with that. and then George like agrees with her. You know, and he says it as if this is like a fact. Because he goes, that's right. And he just heard about it like an hour ago from Clarence. You know, he heard about it in Pottersville.
Yeah.
He didn't even hear about it in Bedford Falls. You know, because he had Nick.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Berating him, the fairies, right? I mean, I like it. I mean, that he's a great actor, because the difference between Bedford Falls Nick and Pottersville Nick is like night and day.
Yeah. The question though is, who's the real Nick? You know, I mean, I've looked at this from the perspective that most of the people, the way they act in Pottersville is probably their true self. Because in Pottersville, they're able to act out however they want, because there's nothing keeping them from doing that. But in Bedford Falls, you know, everything's a little more calm and conservative.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's fair. I think, but it's also Capra trying to tell you not to move to the big city, and that the suburbs aren't everything. You know, I mean, this is very
right.
much
okay, that's true.
Anti, like, I mean, he's painting it that way, but he's also trying to paint it in as negative a way as possible, which is why it's
right. I mean, I think it goes along with the same lines that people say that, you know, when someone is drunk, so their true self comes out.
Yeah,
because they no longer have any inhibitions to stop them. So I think that's how I look at Pottersville, that the people are acting in certain ways because they have no inhibitions that are stopping them. You know, Violet acts like she acts in Pottersville. Not that she acted so much differently in Bedford Falls, but that's a separate issue. But
yeah,
you know, and we never get to, and I think that's why they don't even show us Potter in Pottersville, because we wouldn't believe how crazy Potter is. Because
he's the same. Presumably he's exactly the same. Because
no, I think he's even worse.
I don't think he can be any worse, because he's literally got everything in town but the savings and loan. So if he had the savings and loan, he would still be going. He would have everything in town, and he would be going after the next town. That's probably why we don't see him. He's not in Pottersville anymore. He's going to make Pottersville 2.
Maybe. Okay. That's a fair way of looking at it. And then George hugs Mary as he's telling Zazu that she's right. And then he looks up and goes, "Attaboy, Clarence." Which it always makes me laugh when you hear that, because it's like, I don't know. I mean, basically, I looked up what the term attaboy means. And what it basically, it's just a way to praise someone or try and encourage them to continue doing something that they're doing well.
Okay. I mean, I've only ever heard it, I mean, outside of this film and film, I've only ever heard it in the sports world. And even then, I feel like it's died out. I think, sadly, attaboy has been replaced by let's go, if we're being honest. And I'm not the biggest fan of let's go. I think attaboy should come back.
No, I think it could be like good job, nice job. You know, I think that's more or less what they're trying to say. Well done. Keep it up.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. I actually even looked it up in the Urban Dictionary just to see. Can you believe, I'm not going to explain what it is, because it's just crazy. You have to go there yourself if you want. But there, attaboy also has sexual references. And I'm like, what? Like, where does that come from? But that's the Urban Dictionary for you. A friend of mine, a friend of the show, DJ Valentine, told me, never go to the Urban Dictionary, because you're going to find things out there that you never even thought were possible.
Yeah, yeah, I think.
Just the way that probably,
I don't learn. I'm all for learning, but maybe there's a limit.
Exactly. Like for instance, one of the definitions they give there is, they say it's a derogatory term used when describing a person who seeks constant affirmation for their work or achievements. So it brings as an example, attaboy, Jeter, way to make contact. for all you anti-Yankee fans. Okay. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. What I found out was that it's military in origin. And it's a official recognition or commendation for doing good work. So if that's the case, that actually makes sense that he's saying it next to Harry. Maybe he, you know, starts to think about military things because, you know, he's got his flyer brother right next to him. Who knows?
Yeah.
And then the rest of this minute just shows different people singing.
Yeah.
You know, we see We see Harry singing, and then we see what I now am referring to as the Bedford Falls choir, which is basically everyone who's in their house. And then George starts singing also with them. You know, they get to sing Auld Lang Syne again, which, you know, we talked about two seasons ago with When Harry Met Sally. That's how that movie ended also.
I just feel like it's weird because that's a New Year's song for us now in modern day.
Mm-hmm. And When Harry Met Sally.
And isn't it Christmas in Bedford Falls?
Yeah, but they already sang Hark the Angels Singing. So they moved on from Christmas to New Year's.
Okay.
Maybe they're trying to stay non-denominational for the second song. You know, the first song we're gonna go a certain way, and the second song we're gonna stay non-denominational. Okay. There you go.
Yep.
I don't know why Frank Capra chose to use this song as the second song. It's an uplifting song. It's an uplifting choice. You know, I like the choice. So I mean, can't really complain about that.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about, like, he probably would have, I mean, given the songs that were used, he probably was looking at standards, and
right.
The problem with using something like, I don't know, say When the Saints Go Marching In, is everybody's already in the house. Like, so
that's true.
So that one doesn't make any sense because they're already here.
Right.
You know. So
I think it also has to do with the fact that all this thing is all about friendship.
Yeah. And even the bank examiners put in some money, you know, reluctantly. Oh, sure. But, you know.
Yes. And the sheriff, you know, the sheriff ripped up yesterday the warrant, which, again, I have a problem with this, but okay. You know, I discussed a little bit yesterday the fact that, okay, so he's got money from elsewhere. Does that take away from the fact that the warrant is there because he theoretically broke the law? So, okay, you got money back, so you didn't break the law anymore.
No, I think it has everything to do with the fact that they were trying to do everything by the book, despite the fact that everybody's pretty sure he didn't steal it.
Right.
The illegality, I mean, because that's the weirdest part about this whole thing, is the warrant wouldn't be drawn up because the money was missing. The warrant would be drawn up because we're accusing George Bailey of stealing it.
That's
and
right.
Whether he's covering for his uncle or not, no accusations have been made at any point unless Potter.
No, Potter said he's going to swear a warrant for his arrest.
So, I mean, yeah, but usually, and look, I understand Potter's like the big man in town, but usually it takes more than one witness and one accusation to draw up a warrant.
Especially the person who stole the money themselves.
This is Christmas Eve, by the way.
Yes.
I would like anyone out there to try and get anything done on Christmas Eve that's not shopping. good luck getting a government agency to do anything on Christmas.
Right. Well, it was the 1940s. You know, the weather wasn't that great in fake Bedford Falls. So, I don't know, because it didn't really snow in that area of the country on that day.
Yeah, I just you know what, they did fairly well with the. Like, I mean, I grew up in my high school years were in an idyllic small hamlet of a town. And I feel like, I don't know that Bedford Falls would have been the county seat. But I will tell you that my town was, and it felt like a small town, and Bedford Falls felt like that town to me and many towns around it, which was, you know, northeastern Pennsylvania. So it's close enough to New York that like all those towns would be similar ish. But like, you know, I like the idea that town is that town. And I'll say this now, I'm with Mary. That's the house you buy.
From an investment perspective?
No, from a I want to live in an old Victorian house again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about the fact that Mary and George, as soon as they moved in, probably said to themselves, too bad that we broke some of those windows, a few years back, because now we got to go replace them.
I guarantee you Mary was not upset replacing those windows. She needed that wish to keep George in town, okay?
Right. Okay.
If she misses with her rock, this is a very different movie.
Well, you know the story that Frank Capra didn't think that that she would be able to make the shot. So he had a marksman, off camera getting ready to shoot out the window pane. And she got it on the first shot when she threw the rock.
I mean, if you told me to shoot a free throw, I wouldn't think it would go in the first time. Especially when you say rolling. All right. Like
exactly.
The three practice ones will go in. Okay. Quiet on the set. Rolling. Clang. I guarantee you that's how it works for me. So I'm not.
That's why in most movies, when you have someone taking a shot or you only see them. Have you ever seen the movie 61 it was directed by Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
And about Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle's race for 61 homers in 1961. So I'm a really big fan of that movie, and I've listened to the commentary on it numerous times. And Billy Crystal always talks about it. Well, always, obviously, it's the same commentary every time. But Billy Crystal mentions that most of the shots of people hitting home runs, you see it from the perspective of the batter, meaning you watch the ball go the entire distance, meaning that people are really hitting those home runs. It's not a cut shot where, someone hits the ball and then you cut the shot and then you see the ball land in the stands. You see the continuing shot.
And I mean, that movie specifically is also a testament to the detail and the eye and the love of baseball that Billy has, because those bats are tree trunks. To go on a little baseball tangent, but like what they're swinging these days is a toothpick by comparison to the like massive amounts of lumber that those guys back then used to swing.
That's right. Completely.
And I have one of those bats. And I swing it on occasion and I go, how do you get around on anything that's not soft pitch with this thing? Yeah, it's amazing.
Right. And then as the song basically, the song fades out, and then we get the final shot with the logo of Liberty Films. You see the bell. You see the bell ringing at the very end.
Yeah.
And that's where we're actually going to stop this minute, because I think we're not going to talk about that subliminal second.
We definitely need to go back to like really like good film logos. Like the actual lion in MGM, right? Like the bell for Liberty Films. Like these are really good.
Right. Not the CGI stuff nowadays.
Yeah, I mean I appreciate DreamWorks, but like, that's all CG. Like,
Well, obviously, if it's DreamWorks, you're gonna that they started CGI, so
that's true.
There you go. All right. So, is there anything else you want to say about this movie before we get into the five segments that we're gonna churn out now?
No. Let's just get into it. Well, if anything else pops up, but I think we've talked about everything.
All right. So as always, I'm going to go through all five segments, even though this is one episode. So we'll start with Capra Monday. So Jason, why don't you give me your top five Frank Capra films? Start with number five and work your way up.
Number five, nothing. Number four, nothing. Number three, nothing. Number two is an asterisk, which will come up later, so we'll talk about it then, which is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which I have not seen yet, but I have been told I will like it, and it is on my to-watch list. And then number one is It's a Wonderful Life, because it is the only Frank film that I have actually seen. And so that is my list of Capra films.
Okay, you're in good company, because you are not the only person who has only seen one.
Okay. Yeah.
You're the eighth person who has not seen any other Frank Capra movies out of out of 28 people.
So I would ask you, though, before we move on, is It's a Wonderful Life his most known film?
Define most known by who? I think, you know what? By the way that you phrased that question, I think the answer is yes. Because most people, it doesn't matter if you're a movie fan of classics or if you're even if you're not a movie fan, this is probably the movie that is on TV the most. That people who aren't even affiliated with movie watching, you know, when it comes Christmas time, they're like, hey, look what's on TV. You know, there's this movie, It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay.
So I'm pretty sure that that is the answer.
And then next would probably be Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, I would guess.
You know what? I don't think so. I would say that more people have probably heard of It Happened One Night.
Okay.
That's what I would guess, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is just the one that's in my circle. And it's
correct. Again, people who deal with politics, people who are interested in politics, then they're going to know that it's Mr. Smith. I mean, you can make a case for that being number two also.
Okay.
But I got to say, I think that there is a very long distance between the number of people who've seen It's a Wonderful Life and the number two movie on that list. Absolutely. You know, of what's the most known of Capra movies. But okay. I mean, I think that's fair.
And I want to ask, what have you seen besides It's a Wonderful Life?
What have I seen? I've seen It's a Wonderful Life, Arsenic and Old Lace, It Happened One Night, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, You Can't Take It With You, Lost Horizon,
okay,
Rendezvous in Space, Meet John Doe. Those are the ones that I've seen. Others also. There's something called the Bitter Tea of General Zhao, or something like that. I saw that 2 months ago. But so yeah, I've seen more than one.
Okay.
And people will have to come back tomorrow to hear my top five of that. You know, I'm not going to give that one away today.
I know. Yeah.
But It's a Wonderful Life is on the list. How's that?
Okay.
I'll be. and. No, you know what? I'm not even going to say what else is on the list. I'll let people try and guess. You know, I'll give you 24 hours to start guessing. Yeah. All right. So now we're up to Tuesday's segment. So yes. It's Off the Beaten Track, where it's the inspirational story edition, where my guest will give some sort of inspirational story of an adventure, misadventure, something has happened to them over the course of their life that they felt was either inspiring to them or that they were able to inspire someone else.
So I will say that there were a lot of options here, mainly because
you were a very inspiring person.
You know what it is? And this isn't like tooting my own horn. I prefer to be the producer rather than the host. And that's not just in terms of podcasting. That's in life. I would rather help someone than not. So,
so you know, you're a regular George Bailey.
You know, kind of like you know, one of the things I'm learning about myself as I get older is I'm a lot more of a hippie than I ever thought I was. I know at one point I had the long hair and the beard and I looked like a hippie, but I never actually thought I was one. But apparently I am. I am a regular George Bailey, apparently. And I would say that generally speaking, my junior and senior years of college, my sophomore year of college, I got really involved in campus, just in general. You know, I was president of a club or two. I was writing for the paper. I was involved in student government. Like, I did a lot. I went overboard my sophomore year. And I don't know what kind of happened, but junior year, I started trying to, and I guess this is where the helping people starts. I started trying to kind of back out of every responsibility I had by putting other people who I thought would do better in those positions in for me. And I'm,
so you like being the puppet master?
Not quite, because I let them go. Like, it was very much a like set it and forget it. The one I'm most proud of is one. I'm not gonna name names because I don't want to take too much credit for this, but one of the guys I selected to succeed after me as president of one of the clubs ended up working on Obama's campaign 4 or 5 years down the road. And oh, wow. I feel like I gave him his first real taste of leadership. He's gone on to do way more things. But I'm super proud because I chose him out of a many people. You're in college. How are you going to judge that? Right. I had a feeling. And I went, that's the guy who's going to do it. And it turned out not only great for the club, but in the long term, you know, he's done some great things in politics. And that's it. Surprisingly, still inspiring to me that like all the things he's gone on and done. But I there were others that were not so successful outside of the campus setting. But I got to tell you, it's not quite like you could make an argument that I was a very big fish in a very small pond because it was a very small liberal arts college. And if you're that involved and in that many things, you could literally maybe call me a kingmaker if you wanted to, because I was one of the few students who jumped ship, and I would like have lunch with the administrators or the faculty. Like, I wasn't afraid of talking to people above me. But I was very much a thorn in their sides often. And it taught me a lot about process and I don't want to say red tape, but like just learning how things are done. And I feel like, and I've actually had some people in politics come on the Palmer Files recently, and we don't talk politics. We talk about governance. And I think one of the things that I learned on campus was that if you learn how it works, no matter if you get your way or not, it's much less frustrating. And okay. So I think that when you talk about especially local governance, because national politics are, you know, a mess regardless. But like on the local level, if you understand how things work, it's much easier to A, get things done, and B, understand why things are done, either at the pace they're done or how they're done or what have you.
Right.
And so as a little addendum, I would say that I've started to talk to some legislators or attorneys or lawyers that are treat their jobs not as just governance, but as educators. And they're trying to simplify government so that people can become less frustrated and more knowledgeable, which goes hand in hand, because the more knowledgeable you are, the less frustrated you are. You'll understand why something's taking longer or why something just can't be done at the flip of a hat. And so, right. You know, that's I'm trying to amplify that for other people because they're trying to amplify that for themselves and their own communities. And like, I talk to these people and I'm like, why aren't you in my community? And that's a whole different ball game, but I'm just glad that in any community, some of these people are out there. And so, yeah, I've seen what other people can do. And I think part of, look, I've been a, if you talk to anybody who knew me back in those college days, I was an old man back then. I was a very old man for a college junior and senior. And I'm finally growing into being an old man, which is wonderful, because now my personality fits my actual age. But watching people surpass me has been wonderful. I don't envy them. I just, you know, I'm just happy to have known them at all, and I'm excited at what else they can do, which is the same goes true for anything else. So I think that that's one of those like full circle things, but it eventually comes with age.
Wow.
I think.
Okay, cool. I like that. I like where you took that, that segment. So yes, thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Absolutely.
You know, but, and not using names in order to, accuse the guilty or whatever.
Yeah.
All right. So Wednesday's segment is my segment. It's and this will be the final one that I'm going to do of It's a Wonderful Wednesday, where the idea is that in the 78 years since this movie came out, there have been many different forms of media, whether it's TV shows, movies, books. I talked about radio shows, comic books, plays, you know, in the theater, that have taken the general idea of It's a Wonderful Life and tried to use it for their own story, you know, about how will someone's life, how will people's lives be different if one person wasn't around, or, you know, things like that. I mean, I've gone in different directions with it also, because, you know, very few of the examples that I've used over the last few months are exactly one for one what they did in this movie, but it's just taking the same idea. So for this final one, I decided to go with something from Star Trek.
Okay.
So Star Trek The Next Generation has an episode in season 6. It's season 6, episode 15, called Tapestry. It came out in 1993. And the idea there is that Picard is wounded while on an away mission. And when they bring him back onto the Enterprise, they say that he's dying, and it's because of his artificial heart. And then he gets visited by Q, you know, the character played by John DeLancey, who I always love when he shows up, because he just messes with the time space continuum every single time that he shows up. And
we can talk about that later, because I love that you brought this up, by the way, because I have been educating myself in Star Trek of late.
I know. That's why I chose this one for you.
I am done. I haven't posted my post about Next Gen yet, but I am finished watching it.
And so you've seen this episode. Spoiler,
yeah. As a spoiler, I will tell you, it took me 4 episodes to like Q. It took Q 4 appearances for me to like him. I thought he was annoying.
But Encounter at Farpoint, is that counted as 1 or 2? Encounter at Farpoint.
I count that as 2. I have to count it as 2. But it just takes a while. But Tapestry, you're right. It's because one of the things that I was thinking about was not only Tapestry, although Tapestry does a good job of it, is all of the ones you've probably mentioned throughout the season. Is there anything before this? Like, can I ask that? Like, is this the
first? I didn't use any examples from prior to 1946. No.
But if they were, they were probably only in book form, right? As far as like multimedia.
As far as I know, that is correct. Yes.
Yeah. But Tapestry is a good example of like, what would it be like?
Right.
And to your point about Pottersville,
Well, before we get there, one second, let me actually let people are listening and saying to themselves, wait a second, we didn't tell us what Tapestry is about. So Q shows up, and apparently Picard is going to die because of this artificial heart, that, you know, this injury is going to kill him. And if he had a regular heart, he wouldn't have died from it. So Picard, when he's having this discussion with Q, basically it comes up that, okay, now what would have happened if Picard, when he was a young cadet, didn't get into a brawl that ended up getting him stabbed in the heart and therefore needed an artificial heart. So I really liked what they did with it, because they, you know, this whole episode talks about the fact that, you know, why is it called Tapestry? Because everyone's life is like a tapestry. You have different threads. And if you just remove one of those threads, everything is going to be different. It's going to look different. You're going to act different. You know, the way that our ideas and our conscience and everything that happens to us through the course of our lives, everything's a building block. And if you take one of those building blocks out, you will be a completely different person. And so I really like the way that this fits in with It's a Wonderful Life, because It's a Wonderful Life, George is, you know, the building blocks of George's life is, they're basically everything that George is doing to help others.
Yeah.
And he does it naturally and stuff like that. And if you take those building blocks away, and in It's a Wonderful Life, these building blocks that George creates touch other people. And if you take those away and they don't have those building blocks, so then everyone is not on the same level. I mean, the Tapestry takes the story in a different direction by doing that. It talks only about how it will affect Picard. You know, Picard doesn't become the potential of what he should have become without having that incident of him getting stabbed and everything that happened from it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, in Tapestry, we do get our Clarence moment, so to speak. Like, we do get to fast forward a little bit.
Right.
And it's almost like Pottersville. Like, everybody's the same, but a little bit more amplified. Like, it's just, it's kind of that same.
Except for Picard. Picard is not amplified. Picard is actually the exact opposite.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing that drives Picard nuts. The fact that he knows he's not himself there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's I guess you can say it's the opposite of Pottersville, because in Pottersville, everyone else has changed. In this one, you know, you're looking at it from the perspective of like a photo negative, where the only person who's changed here is Picard. And and how does that affect him? And everyone else, you know, things happen around them. Obviously, you know, obviously there are other things that happen that are changed also because of it. But, you know, it just, I like what they did with it. I was very glad to rewatch this episode today in order to, you know, bring it here as the final choice for It's a Wonderful Wednesday.
It's definitely a good, yeah. I mean, I like it. It's still relatively fresh in my mind too. So,
right. So, what were you going to say about Pottersville?
Just that it's that amplified nature, like of everything when he's gone, when that one person's gone. I mean, it's the cool thing to do in movies and television is like when that one person's gone, because Picard very much is the Bailey, not really, but like as far as a calming influence on he's everyone else around him.
Yeah, that's right.
And so the amplification of everything else is funny, although it does get buried in a series like Next Gen. It gets buried in with a few of the alternate reality episodes or alternate universe episodes, and that's where maybe Tapestry doesn't stand out as much, because we've seen other alternates which are also very It's a Wonderful life. Like, you know, because it's very much like I can't remember the episode, but there's an episode where Worf ends up as one of Worf is in a time loop, basically, or in a time space problem. It's not even a continuum. And he's just living on five different enterprises, but he's the same him. And so we get to see all these different things, and every universe, based on the theory that there's a universe for everything, is based off of a different choice he made in past. So that's another one. And I think maybe because Trek did it a few times, like Tapestry is just like one of the many, but they're all fairly good as far as establishing that who you are now is very much a product of what you've been through and the decisions you've made to get there. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. And that works really well. All right. So we're up to Thursday. So Thursday segment is Jimmy Stewart Thursday, where my guest gets to talk about the top five performances of Jimmy Stewart. And I have a feeling that we're going to have a reoccurrence.
Yes.
I'm looking at your face and I'm seeing you laughing.
But number five.
I will be very disappointed if Friday segment is also something that you say you can only give one for. So
I wrote something for Friday. So I'm excited for that. But okay, number five is going to be his scripted / unscripted work, his television work. And that would be Laugh-In / his Dean Martin roast stuff. Because if I'm being completely honest with everyone out there, that's my first introduction to Jimmy Stewart, is through like the Dean Martin roasts, because I'm pretty sure, I mean, maybe I had remembered It's a Wonderful Life, but I didn't know him in that way. And so seeing him on like a show like Laugh-In or on the Dean Martin roasts and having people make fun of him is very much not. And I'm not just talking about his particular roast. I'm talking about just him being up there on the dais and people taking shots at him. That's probably my first introduction to Jimmy Stewart. Number four is the asterisk of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, because I understand everyone tells me I will like that. So I put it on the list because I wanted to fill out five just for you, Rob, because I know you'd be upset if I didn't come up with five.
Yeah, but they have to count. So you see, I don't count Mr. Smith because you haven't seen it.
It's still number three is actually It's a Wonderful Life for me. I like it, but I kind and I think ironically, number three of being It's a Wonderful Life is a little bit more rewatchable for me than number two, but I really like number two. Number two is Strategic Air Command. And Strategic Air Command is basically a story of a it depends on your favorite baseball team, right? But basically he's a veteran pitcher, or he's a veteran ball player, and he gets his one of his final seasons gets derailed by World War II because he gets reenlisted. And then the rest of it's more of a war film. But I don't know. There's something about the early part of that film when he's just trying to be a baseball player, and then the war interrupts. And, you know, you can take your pick. Again, depending on who your favorite, you know, is it Ted Williams? Is it Roger Maris? Is it, you know, like there are plenty of guys of that era that also had their careers interrupted by the war. So take your pick. But I enjoy his performance there. I really do. And then number one, my favorite Jimmy Stewart performance, and probably my favorite Jimmy Stewart film as of right now, is The Philadelphia Story.
Because you live near Philadelphia?
No, I like it. So interesting thing about The Philadelphia Story, I'm very much a man of finding things the wrong way. Did I watch Philadelphia Story first? Absolutely not. The first movie I saw in that vein was High Society. High Society is the musical version of The Philadelphia Story. So sure. I was like, I really like High Society, which I mean, look, it's got Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra. What's not to like? But I was like, I want to know what the non-musical version looks like. And I watched the Philadelphia Story and I went, oh, I really like the Philadelphia Story. Like, if like all things being equal, I think I like the Philadelphia. As I get older, I think I like the Philadelphia Story more than High Society. And for that reason, it is my number one Jimmy Stewart.
Okay, that is fair. Thank you very much for that. Okay, now we are up to the final segment, the Friday segment, Oscar Oops, where the idea is that my guests get to talk about what movies they think over the last 96 years of Oscar, that mistakes were made and that a different movie should have been the one to win Best Picture for. So if you tell me you don't have any here, I think our friendship is completely over. But
well,
what's the order for this?
Can I just do any order at all?
You can do like, well, you're supposed to do it in you know your top five with, but you choose how you want to do that. But, you can do it chronologically.
These are not ordered. I mean, basically, I have it chronologically. So for me, it's hard. Partly it's hard because much to the dismay of Edward O'Hare, I don't care about awards. No matter how much he tries to tell me, I should care about awards and I should watch the award show.
I don't care about awards either, but I love watching the award show. That's the difference. Okay. That's why Eddie and I talk about the Oscars before it happens. You know, we both do the Oscar challenge. You know, this year I got all of them but one of the shorts I wasn't able to watch, but I don't count the shorts in my, you know, in the thing that I do, because I, you know, in my country, I don't have the opportunity, you know, to go to a theater and watch all 15 shorts. So, you know, the fact that I was able to find 14 out of 15 of them, I give myself a huge pat on the back for that one.
I give you all the credit in the world too, because that stuff's not easy.
But it's
so
fun.
I went through the list. Yeah, but I preface that to say I went through the list because I was like, all right, what here can I easily argue against?
Okay.
As far as like, okay, there's something else on the list. And so I immediately locked on to 1997, where Titanic won. I think I would have given it to Good Will Hunting, and I'll tell you why. I care a little bit more about a good written script than I do about the theatrical nature of the thing. So I think Good Will Hunting is a much better script than Titanic. Is Titanic a technical marvel? Yes. Does that make it the best picture? No, not in my book. So 1997 was the first one where I was like, all right, yeah, let's throw out Titanic and put in Good Will Hunting.
Okay.
I then go back to 1983, where two of my all-time favorite movies did not win because Terms of Endearment won. And I would go, all right, so do I give it to The Right Stuff or The Big Chill? And I think that in that same argument for Good Will Hunting, The Right Stuff is a great script and a technical marvel, but I think The Big Chill is a much better movie.
Okay. And it goes with the fact that the script is probably, you know, the dialogue and the characters are.
Yeah. And I didn't want this to be a cop-out because I wanted to put a little more thought into it. The other thing is The Big Chill is a little bit more original than The Right Stuff, which is based off of a book, The Right Stuff.
Oh, hello. It's not original because it took place.
Yeah, well, but being based on a true story is not necessarily a thing, but like The Right Stuff was adapted from an amazing book. The Big Chill was an original script, and right. I would give that a little bit more.
Okay.
And yeah.
So okay, those
are the two that jumped out. Then I went, oh crap, I got to fill out my list so I don't disappoint Rob. So I got to pick three more. And so I was going down I went further down the list, and I get to 1981, and I go, you know what? Everybody loves Chariots of Fire, but you know what? in hindsight, because I can't be in the moment, in hindsight, Raiders of the Lost Ark started something that I guess Marvel is still attempting to recapture every time they put out a movie. And so I think in 81, I go back and I give it to Spielberg and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Okay.
Going back even further, I go back to 1969 and I say, to hell with Midnight Cowboy. Let's give it to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Anyway, because I think Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid for me is one of those perfect Westerns, because it's after all the Westerns. It's also poking fun at all the Westerns, but it still itself is a Western. And I love that dichotomy. And then because I didn't want to disappoint you, Rob. And I was like, what else is on this list that I can put here? So I am going to my man, going to 1966. I'm throwing away A Man for All Seasons, and I'm giving it to Michael Caine and Alfie. Those are my five Oscar oops.
I think we're going to give it to to Palmer. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was a part of me that was like, I could just make this all, I could give it to Hannah and her sisters, the Caine Mutiny, which is where Michael Caine got his name. Like, I was just, there was a part of me that almost went full Michael Caine, but I decided not to. I would just give the final slot to him.
Okay. That's very cool. Thank you very much. A very original way to do this, but I didn't expect anything different from you. Which is why I love having you on as a guest.
Oh, it's a blast. It's always a blast. I mean, that's the other thing. I'm looking at this list going like, some of these, like I remember the drama with like La La Land and all that stuff. But at the same time, I didn't watch it. That was one I only saw in like hindsight on social. I just know it was a big deal because it was a big deal, but not for any other reason. So it's like, right.
Okay. All right. That's fair. Thank you very much for all of those segments. So Jason, is there anything else you want to talk about with this movie, or have we talked it all out?
I feel like we've talked it all out. I mean, you've done this for 130 episodes, which,
yes,
granted, you do. I mean, when you do older, longer movies, you tend to do that with they're older and longer. But I did want to ask you, like, is there like has your appreciation of the film changed talking to all these different people over the course of this 130 episodes?
Absolutely.
Or do you still appreciate it the same way you did?
No, I don't know if it's because, I don't think it was just because of the conversations. There's also the idea that when I'm doing the research and when I'm watching things, you know, minute by minute, I've noticed things that I never would have noticed otherwise. And that most people don't notice. Okay. I mean, I can just ask a few questions and you'll say to yourself, and I don't know. I mean, you tell me that you've seen this movie numerous times, but there are questions that I can ask you that you'll say to yourself, hey, you know what? I never thought about that. Like, how does Mr. Potter get up to the second floor of the building alone?
Yeah. No, I mean, presumably, outside of just answering with movie magic, I would assume that his man walks him up, puts him on a chair outside, goes back down out in a waiting room, and then walks back up and, you know, brings up the chair.
Exactly. But again, it's something that doesn't sound practical.
Or he's less invalid than we're led to believe.
Okay. You've now hit on the theory that I've brought up many, many times over the last 130 episodes, where he's just faking it. He's not really in a wheelchair. So it's possible, you know, and again, I can go on and on. I could ask you other questions and you'll be like, hey, I didn't notice that. I didn't wonder that.
So I guess the real question is,
and that's why I like doing this.
Do you watch this around the holiday season?
Well, again, I don't celebrate Christmas, as you know. So for me, it's not. I watch movies at any time of the year. I don't have like a specific time that I need to watch certain things. It's not like I watch Groundhog Day on Groundhog Day. You know, I can watch it any day of the year. It doesn't make a difference to me.
Does having gone through it minute by minute now, basically to the end, are you more inclined to want to watch this, or like maybe put it on a shelf and give it some rest?
No, I'm more inclined to watch it. I've rewatched every one of the movies that I've done. And most of the time I rewatch them also when I finish the season, you know, because then I have a whole new appreciation for each and every one of these movies because of the way that I break it down to, some people might think a nauseating level, but, you know, I just find it fun.
I mean, I don't think it's a nauseating level. I mean, I remember memorizing it's not before fantasy baseball, but like before I knew of fantasy baseball, I had statistics memorized for my favorite players. That's quite a way for a 10-year-old to spend his time. You know, I mean, we've all kind of gone deeper than we needed to with anything we're passionate about. So I don't begrudge that.
Right. I mean, I did the fantasy baseball thing for many years also, and did the same thing. You know, you just go in very deep into these things, and you know, I like being able to go very deep into movies like this because it gives me more of an appreciation of everything that transpires in the movie. And the most unfortunate thing that constantly happens is the fact that, you know, I can't go and ask anybody, is this true? You know, that type of thing. I can't call up Frank Capra and say, what were you thinking when you made this particular decision? You know,
that's fair. Yeah.
You know, that would be cool if I could do that, but I can't do it.
And when you go to older movies, the press didn't ask those questions. I mean, now, you know, even though you might not be able to call up Chris Nolan, somebody may have already asked him that question. So there's a potential, because we watch films in a very different way in Correct. 2024 mm-hmm. than we did back then. And the media watches it and critics watch it differently too. So it's, while you don't have his number, you may be able to get an answer to one of those questions versus now.
I mean, earlier this week, I did ask, you know, Donna Reed's daughter some of the questions that I had, and she had no clue. You know, it wasn't things that she had discussed with her mom, you know, 40 years ago. So,
yeah, that's
exactly. All right, great. So, Jason, would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
Yeah, I'm on all the socials at Agent Palmer, which at the moment I'm more of a lurker than an active participant. But if you want to hit me up because you're listening, I am on Mastodon and I am on Threads and Twitter and, you know, everybody's free to, you know, email me at theagentpalmer@gmail.com. I'm an open book. That's fine. If you disagreed with anything, hey, let me know, or just sound off in the comments and engage the algorithm for Rob. That's fine too. He'll let me know that you were angry or not. And if you enjoyed this conversation, I have conversations with people every other week on my podcast, The Palmer Files. And I am, slowly approaching, a number of episodes equal to just this season of Rob's.
I was going to say you're nowhere near the, actually, you know what? Today's episode is my 750th. I forgot to even mention that. What do you know?
Well, I am not that prolific at all, but I do have approximately 90 minute free form conversations with all kinds of people. And, you know, before that started, and as that continues, I still blog every Thursday on agentpalmer.com, writing about books I've read or movies I've read or my Star Trek journey. So, all of those places will, continue to be a way to get a hold of me. And if Rob invites me back for the penultimate of the next one, and you only like Rob, that's fine. You can just wait for me to come back on this show.
That is the plan. The plan is to have you back next season too. You know, I finally got my hooks into you to at least get you to show up for one episode. So there you go. That's
I'm I'm fine with it. Let's do it. Yeah.
Me too. All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. I will be back tomorrow for the finale of this season, along with my regular guest slash sort of co-host for that episode, Jake Lewitt. So come back tomorrow. But until then, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.